The Bottom Line is made possible in part by Big D Construction. This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today I'm speaking with Tim Sullivan, President and CEO of Ancestry.com. According to many, genealogy is one of America's most popular hobbies, second only to gardening. Utah-based Ancestry.com is the world's largest online family history resource. Under Tim Sullivan's leadership, Ancestry.com has grown to over 3 million paying subscribers, generates more than $500 million a year in revenue, and was recently sold to a private equity firm for $1.6 billion. Tim, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Doug, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So Ancestry is a big company now, as noticed by the $1.6 billion price tag. So you guys do many different things. When people ask you what Ancestry.com does, how do you answer that?
We are incredibly focused on family history, right? And we're trying to find new ways to deliver on the mission we've had for a long time, which is to help people discover, preserve, and share their family history.
Okay, great. In the intro, I borrowed the description online family history resource from an interview that you did recently. And I know Google, Facebook, Yahoo, and most tech companies now are really focused on mobile and kind of the next wave and the role that mobile plays. How important is the mobile experience to Ancestry.com's customers?
Well, it's a really great question. The short answer is it's very important. We have built what we think are some really wonderful mobile apps for both iOS and Android. And we built them primarily to be, I'd say, an extension of the desktop experience. In other words, longtime subscribers who have built an extensive family tree, a mobile app is a great way to have that work with them at any point, find a few minutes between appointments and do a little family history work. The interesting thing that's happening, though, is as more and more people spend more and more of their time on mobile devices, we're finding an increasing number of people that are starting with a mobile experience. And that's both an opportunity for us and a challenge. The challenge is that the core thing that we do does require a little bit of keyboard interface.
And maybe a little more screen space.
And a little more screen space.
Yeah.
Now, the good news is I think the things that we need to do to make Ancestry easy on a mobile device are the same things we've been trying to do and we're continuing to do to make the service on a desktop just easier, more easy and user-friendly and frankly a little more fun, so that eventually we think that we can further develop that user experience in which someone can do the vast majority of the things that they today do on the desktop on a mobile device.
And I would think most folks have a couple people in their family that are really into doing the research, and the other people find it fun to find out, oh, hey, we found a new relative in Europe or wherever. And that would be a great application for mobile. So grandma and grandpa are doing some research and pass down to the grandkids, hey, did you know you were related to so-and-so from Ireland?
I remember sitting in my backyard, I think, last summer, and my mobile device buzzed, and I looked down, and there was an alert from Ancestry, and I clicked through it and found a photograph, and I was sitting with my kids, young teenagers, and I showed them and said, guess who this is? This is your great-great-great-grandmother.
It's a cool world we live in, isn't it?
They've not been really interested in family history, but that kind of stuff actually starting to get them intrigued.
Right, and get the conversation going.
Exactly.
On some of the heritage and the legacy of your family.
That's right.
So speaking of different products, I interviewed Ken Shaheen up in Park City for a radio show up there a couple years ago now. And he was talking about a new product at the time that Ancestry had launched about DNA that's related to DNA. And I was just blown away with what you guys were doing. Share with us about what that service is.
Well, it's a really exciting new service at Ancestry. I say new. We launched it 2 years ago. But it has continued to grow. And it's a DNA test that we sell for $99 that tells people both something about their ethnicity makeup, and I'll explain how we do that, but also connects people to, fourth, fifth, even sometimes sixth cousins, which for a family historian is an incredibly valuable way to make new discoveries. So, for instance, if I have been blocked at one person in my family tree, and this is the case for me, I don't know really anything about my great-grandfather other than – I don't know anything about my grandfather, great-grandfather before he came to the United States. Eventually, as our database gets larger and larger, I'm going to connect to that third cousin or fourth cousin that maybe has actually researched through that person and has broken through that brick wall.
Because you've done the DNA test, and if your third or fourth cousin does the DNA test, your system will be able to recognize that as a match. Is that
exactly
correct?
So what's a great opportunity for us is not only are we building this massive database of people that have taken the Ancestry DNA test, but most of those people have built out really large family trees. And so we're really aggregating some really powerful data. We're a content company. At the end of the day, we exist because we've digitized a massive quantity of historical archival documents over the year. DNA is now a new kind of content for us, and it's really going to lead to some both phenomenal discoveries for subscribers that have been with us for years and years and years, but it's going to be a new way to really get a whole new generation of people, I think, interested in family history.
I looked up an old interview that Ken did. It wasn't on my show. It was a different interview that he did, but I was struck by a quote that he had. His vision for DNA service was, we're going to be able to tell what town an ancestor lived in and when they lived there. This was 2 years ago. Is that vision now a reality? Can you really tell them what town that their relatives came from this tool?
We're not quite there, but we are moving in that direction. And it really is one of the great things we're going to be able to do is as more and more people, again, take this test and the database gets larger and more of those people have family trees, we've got a team of incredible PhD data scientists and bioinformatics folks who are developing some really powerful algorithms that will eventually be able to triangulate different people that have taken the test who may have a shared ancestor. And you may come in someday, never having done any family history research, take a test, and we may be able to introduce you to one of your ancestors. So this is all in the realm of the possible. It's about great science. It's a extremely challenging technology problem dealing with just massive amounts of data. But we are making progress, and we're pretty excited about it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tim Sullivan, President and CEO of Ancestry.com. I think it's a really cool product, and I was blown away when I was doing my research for talking with Ken that Ancestry was planning on offering the service for $99. And at the time, you weren't sure on the pricing. And I see that you actually did settle on the $99. But let's broaden the discussion on pricing. How do you think about pricing? What is the right price? So here's an incredibly powerful tool. And you have people that would probably happily spend $1,000. And then you have other people that wouldn't do it unless it was $10. So as you think about pricing your products, how do you go about doing that?
Well, to take the DNA service as an example, I think I could say a couple things. Our goal is to absolutely make it as affordable as possible. We're not actually even seeking to make money right now with our DNA test.
I would guess you're not at $99.
No, not with all of the costs involved with the team of scientists we have that are building out sort of the next phase of this service. But it is about network effect. We really want to be the largest personal genomics company. 23andMe is a company that's has a little bit of a larger database than we do, but our goal is to catch them and surpass their database size, and we think that's within our abilities. It's also a great way. It's potentially a loss leader for us if we can sell a kit to someone for, let's say, over time the cost structure comes down. We'd like to lower the price over time, and one thing I say internally is someday we'd like everyone to start their experience with Ancestry by taking a DNA test if they choose to do so. and potentially at no cost or something very, very inexpensive, because it
gives
is
them a better experience right out of the, door.
Exactly. It gives them a better experience right out of the door, and it's frankly just makes their experience, well, as you said, much better.
I want to share a quote that I came across that you gave at a panel discussion recently. You said, "We don't want to build things because they're cool, but because they provide a better experience." And that seemed like a good guiding principle for a CEO of a company to be sharing. And talk to us about how that principle has helped you with decisions, maybe not like DNA, but other types of decisions where you've said, maybe mobile 5 years ago when maybe it was too early. Tell me about some projects that maybe you said no to because you were holding true to that principle, and projects that maybe financially aren't going to make sense for a couple years, but you said yes to because it's the right thing to do.
Well, again, a great question. I think one of the sort of contextual realities is that family history is something that is at one level interesting to almost everyone. Not everyone's a genealogist. Not everyone wants to subscribe to a research-oriented service.
But everybody wants to know about their family at some level.
Everybody wants to know about their family and where they came from. It's a very I don't say this in a way that's a criticism of our users, but it's kind of a narcissistic vision. I want to know about myself, and we all love
We're
that.
We're worried that way.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, yet, doing family history research traditionally has been very, very difficult, right? I mean, before Ancestry and before the internet, you had to travel to archives and scroll through microfilm, which is still a very, very great way to do research.
There are probably dozens of people doing that right down the street from us right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's certain things that you just can't do online that you can only do by going to the Family History Library here in Salt Lake or some other archive. But a lot of our technology investments are really focused on trying to take something which is complex, which is not easy. And we're not trying to build push-button genealogy. It's never going to be so easy that you can just immediately find everything you want to know.
But do you think that would take some of the fun out of it?
It would take it really is as much about the process of discovery, about the journey. We all like being detectives and making these discoveries ourselves. So all of our the vast majority of our technology investments really are focused on trying to take something that is complex and make it easier. And that's about growing the market. So the easier we can make Ancestry without, importantly, alienating the dedicated, serious enthusiast genealogists that use our service, we want to create a product that just takes less time to make discoveries.
Give me an example of a service or a tool that you could put out there that would alienate your existing users.
Well, let me wind the clock back. And 10 years ago, Ancestry was a wonderful search engine. We had built a service. Again, my predecessors to me had done a fantastic job leading the business, had invested in digitizing tremendous archival content, and there was a very good search experience. One of the things we did about 7-8 years ago was begin to do more searching in the background, some intelligent searching that we call hints. And now as you build your family tree and there's a little shaky leaf on your great-great-grandfather, that indicates that our searching in the background that's done by analyzing all the data around that person and for that person, we're going to suggest hints to people. Now, some dedicated serious family historians don't want us to do any of that
work.
That's
cheating.
Yeah, it's cheating.
To me, it sounds wonderful, but yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, that's right. And it also, these are only suggestions. We're never representing that these hints are absolutely, always going to be the right match for the person in that tree. But what we try to do is make them work for both that new user who's never done any family history research, but also somebody who maybe has been a subscriber for 10 years. And I hear stories all the time of serious genealogists that are making discoveries on Ancestry because of our hint systems and the algorithms
powered. Is that why you decided to go with the leaf, the shaking leaf, as opposed to like on LinkedIn, it'll say, hey, here's 20 people you might know. There's not a shaking leaf. It just, boom, here's their picture. Here's their names. Do you want to connect?
Well, it's so funny. That shaky leaf was added. I don't even recall, the specific decision to make it a shaky leaf, but it has turned into this just iconic indication of discovery. And it's really, today, I think you could argue it's arguably the most important part of the service.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more with Tim Sullivan, President and CEO of Ancestry.com. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today, we're speaking with Tim Sullivan, President and CEO of Ancestry.com. This is back to when you went to the University of North Carolina as probably a 17 or 18-year-old. You were on the Morehead scholarship there, which a lot of folks may not have heard of, but they should have. I mean, it's the equivalent of the Rhodes Scholarship. It's extremely prestigious, which says a lot about the type of candidate you were applying to school. That you went to the University of North Carolina, graduated there, and decided to start your own company right out of college, which most, especially back then, you and I are about the same age, mm-hmm. so this is in the 80s, early 80s, mid-80s,
yep.
That you graduated college. That was probably pretty unusual. Why did you decide to start your own business, and what do you think you learned from that experience so early on?
Well, I wish I could tell you I had a master plan that kicked into place the day I graduated, but I didn't. And I graduated. I actually was working on a little project of video production for the Morehead Foundation. You're quite right, was a wonderful, prestigious opportunity to attend the University of North Carolina. So when I originally graduated, I was working on this film it was a recruitment film, or a film to explain what the Morehead program was for scholars that had been nominated for it. And when that project finished, I realized, wait a minute, I've graduated from college. I haven't really lined up my career, and I don't really know yet what I really want to do. And this company had been founded by a very good friend of mine, a couple friends of mine in Chapel Hill, and they asked me to join. And now I'll tell you also, my now wife was still at Carolina, so sticking around Chapel Hill very, very motivated to not leave town without her. But it worked out great. We continued dating for a few years, ultimately got married right before I went to business school. But it was a fantastic learning experience. I thought I was I really thought I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker. And I learned over those couple of years working in the small business that I really enjoyed the process of running the business, of even paying the bills and balancing the books and coming up with sales presentations. But I also enjoyed editing and filming the video itself. So it was a great all-around experience.
You went to Harvard Business School. And out of Harvard Business School, you decided to join Disney and spent 8 years at Disney, which, may not sound that long to a lot of folks, but for a young Harvard Business School graduate, that's an eternity. Most of your classmates, probably 2 years max. So your classmates were like, what are you still doing at Disney? What were you learning at Disney, and why did you decide to stay there for 8 years?
Well, I think the key is that I just kept learning, and that's why I stayed there for 8 years. I had the good fortune of joining as a senior financial analyst. I was doing budgeting and forecasting and nothing too glamorous right out of business school. But I had the good fortune of joining a division that was small but growing very rapidly, international home video. So this was a time that home video itself was really just starting to explode inside Disney. We were re-releasing, bringing out from the library some of the old animated classics. And, of course, films like Lion King and Toy Story were becoming massive successes.
It was a long time till they released Snow White on video.
Yeah, that's right. We built up the anticipation as long as we could. And I worked in the international group, which was also growing very, very rapidly. So I joined what was a small company inside Disney. It was a small team, and I had the good fortune of being able to, over time, being patient with the pace of getting promoted in a big company like that, I did have the good fortune of taking on more and more responsibility. I'd say around that time where maybe one might have been thinking about moving on to the next opportunity, I had the chance to move to Hong Kong and help set up the Asia Pacific regional office in Hong Kong. And around the time that I was ready to come back after 2 years, I was given the opportunity to run the region. So it was a series of somewhat opportunistic decisions to continue my growth and learning inside a great company, and really was a great experience.
That's part of the challenge, too. I mean, working for a big company has its negatives, but it also has its positives. You get these other experiences. A chance to go to Hong Kong is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for most of us. But looking back now, and we'll get to this in a second, you decide to leave Disney and join City Search here in Salt Lake City. Looking back at that, do you wish maybe you had left Disney 2 or 3 years earlier, or do you think that was the right amount of time for you?
Well, it's a great question. I will say that ultimately the reason I leapt from Disney over to Ticketmaster Online City Search was very much realizing that this internet thing was for real and that it was going to change the world and that there was just so many different ways, so many different opportunities to help transform businesses or start new ones.
So let's talk about this internet thing, because a friend of
Flash
mutual friend mutual friend of ours, Tom Stockham, started a company called City Search. And City Search was able to get you away from Disney,
yeah,
and bring you on board. I suspect Tom was part of that recruiting process as well. But that's a big change. I mean, we were talking again in the green room. I'd been to City Search's office in 98, 99, and your desk were door tops on seesaws, essentially, or milk crates. That's a lot different than your experience at Disney. What did you see as the risk of saying yes to Tom and coming on board and helping to build City Search?
Yeah, well, actually, I was based in L.A.
Okay.
And actually didn't come to Utah until I joined Ancestry. But I began some conversations with the then CEO, a guy named Charles Kahn, who was the founder of the business. And originally, my conversations with him were about potentially me coming over as CFO. So I at the time was running a business inside Disney. I was managing director. So I had really left the finance world behind, and I was now a general manager. But
you had P&L responsibility.
I had P&L responsibility at Disney. But I was so intrigued by the company and by the space that I was very consciously willing to take a lateral move or even back to the finance role. Now, as it turned out, they found a much better candidate than me for CFO. But ultimately, Charles asked if I wanted to come on and be the vice president of e-commerce with a mission to try to figure out how Ticketmaster could become a retailer of concert paraphernalia or music. And I went from running a really large region at Disney to joining this internet business that wasn't making money, and I had two people working with me. And so I was back to the old days of really just trying to figure out what the opportunity was without a lot of resources and a lot of capital and make a go of it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tim Sullivan, president and CEO of Ancestry.com. I want to go back kind of more to current day here at Ancestry. Last year, Ancestry announced an agreement with the LDS Church's genealogy group, Family Search, to bring their genealogy records online. I know you've already done a lot of those, so this is probably a new archive that's not currently online. I was blown away by the cost estimate. You were interviewed somewhere and anticipated it was going to cost $60 million over 5 years to do that. When I first read it, I was thinking this is a $5 million, maybe at most $10 million project. Why is it so expensive to bring this stuff online?
Well, we spend, we spend right now about $30 million a year digitizing new content all the time and bringing new content, as you say, onto the service. So remember, we're dealing with oftentimes paper records or maybe microfilm, and there's two steps that we have to undergo to make this content usable on our service. We've got to image it. And so that means, either scanning the microfilm or if it's paper, putting a piece of paper down on a machine, taking a photograph effectively, taking it off by hand. These are old, fragile, very historic documents.
And there's probably a specified way to handle that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you're dealing with handwritten documents. And for those to be searchable, they have to be transcribed. And there is no optical character recognition technology that can read 19th century handwritten documents that are oftentimes smudged and difficult to read. So we have to go through a whole process of transcribing those documents. We do that with a network of highly skilled offshore vendors that have developed a specialty in partnering with Ancestry to digitize this content. And it's very expensive. Now, why do we do that? Content is the foundation of our value proposition. So long as we're continuing to add massive quantities of new records to the service every year, we're confident that we can continue to deliver new discoveries to people. I've been on Ancestry for 9 years, and every time we add a new collection, or not every time, but a lot of times, I'll get a new shaky leaf. I get a new record of, I found my great-grandparents' wedding record. It was the same great-grandparent I was referring to earlier from the Massachusetts Vital Records Collection that we just put online, 6 months ago. So it's a never-ending process of discovery, and content that we digitize in partnership with these archives is the thing that really fuels that process of discovery.
When you left Harvard and said, okay, this is kind of the path I want to be on, it sounds like you knew you wanted to be in senior leadership role, probably a CEO position. Now you run a company, you're CEO of a company that sold for $1.6 billion. It's a big company. Is being CEO of a big company what you thought it would be? And what are the surprises that, what's different than what you thought it would be?
Well, I love my job. There's no question. I love this company, and I feel just tremendously fortunate to be able to work at Ancestry and to lead just a fantastic group of employees. I think the biggest thing that I've learned, and I never would have guessed this, because I didn't do particularly well in human resources management when I was at business school, my job is an HR job. It's about finding great people, leaders who are really expert in their areas of expertise, finding great people, making sure that we're organized properly, and constantly making tweaks to that organization. And a company like ours is growing, constantly evolving, and the way we were organized a year ago was perfect for what we needed to accomplish then. And then you wake up one day and realize, gosh, we've really grown in this area, and we would be better off combining these two functions and moving somebody over here and moving them overseas. So I spend a lot of my time just, making sure that we have absolutely the best leaders. And we do. We have a fantastic leadership team at the company right now. But thinking a lot about the organizational dynamics of how should we be organized to get to, the next goal.
Well, Tim, thank you for joining us this morning. Millions of people enjoy using Ancestry.com every day. I thank you for telling us your company story, and especially for sharing your personal journey with us today.
Doug, it was a huge pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Our guest this morning has been Tim Sullivan, President and CEO of Ancestry.com. This show is brought to you in part by Big D Construction and was recorded at KCPW Studios on Library Square. It was produced by Ross Chambliss with technical support by Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.